and welcome back to Future Cities Podcast. My name is Alicia Helmrich, and I'm assistant professor at the University of Georgia in the College of Engineering. Today, I have three amazing people here to discuss heat risk in Phoenix, Arizona. Pretty timely since it's still scorching hot outside. Let's meet them.
Hi, my name is Julia Zubin, and currently I'm a postdoc working on developing heat mitigation strategies for tropical and highly urbanized Singapore. But previously, I lived in Tempe while I was doing my PhD, and there I worked on Urban Resilience to Extremes Sustainability Research Network, addressing heat perceptions in Phoenix. I'm interested in exploring relationships between the urban environment, human health, and perceptions of heat.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me today. I'm really grateful to be here and to share this information with the broader community. I am currently living in Phoenix right now, but am going to very soon be living on the road in a converted school bus, traveling around to different places. So that's really amazing. I am presently working as a personal coach, otherwise known as a life coach. I am a yoga teacher, and I'm also supporting a family in helping regenerate and restore their 700-acre ranch in Colorado. So working a lot with the land and how to go about doing that, where to get finances for it. And I am most interested in exploring the connections, and more specifically, the disconnections between humans and nature. So for me, this means how we connect to ourselves is a gateway for us to connect more with nature. So essentially, my mission, my focus, and what I explore in my work is how by healing ourselves within, we can translate that to healing all around in the external world, especially our planet.
I'm Dave Hondula. I'm an associate professor in ASU's School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning, and currently serving as the Director of Heat Response and Mitigation for the City of Phoenix.
Thank you all for speaking with me today. Let's jump right in. Dave, could you provide our listeners with some background on climate in Phoenix and the associated public health and environmental challenges posed by extreme heat in the Valley?
Our community and economic development team at the City of Phoenix has a branding slogan that Phoenix is hot, and they got it exactly right. Phoenix is hot based on where we're situated on the globe. Phoenix and cities, many cities at similar latitudes are among the hottest places on the earth. One could argue we're in the same climate zone as Death Valley, where one of the hottest temperatures, or maybe the hottest temperature ever recorded on planet Earth was made. Phoenix is especially hot compared to its surrounding areas because of the way we've developed the city over the past 50, 60, 70 years. Phoenix suffers from what is sometimes called an urban heat island, which is true for many other cities as well. But here, it's already hot, and then we have a little extra heat on top of that because of our historical development patterns. And all that heat adds up to significant public health impacts, unfortunately. In each of the past 2 years, we've had more than 300 people die from heat exposure in Maricopa County. That's in the same order of magnitude as the number of people that die from homicides. And think about how many resources we mobilize to try to prevent and investigate homicides. And beyond those heat-associated deaths, which themselves are plenty tragic, many times more people go to the hospital for heat illness, and many times more people than that report having some impact on their health, even if it doesn't require formal medical treatment. So heat is a public health impact that really can affect us all, and it does affect us all in different ways. But for some people, it's a very, very serious health hazard.
Thank you. Thank you for that contextualization of the heat problem in Phoenix. We're going to go ahead and transition. The remainder of this episode will be split into three separate segments with our guests. First, Yulia will be discussing her recent work in Edison East Lake neighborhood. You can also read more about it in the publication, Evidence of Alesthesia During a Neighborhood Thermal Walk in a Hot and Dry City, and the link will be in the description. Yulia, let's start with, what is alesthesia?
Right. Imagine entering an air-conditioned room after a walk on a hot day. Would you feel an immediate relief and pleasure? So this phenomenon would be called positive thermal alesthesia. In physiological terms, when there is an environmental stimulus that helps to move thermal load of the body towards equilibrium, our thermal receptors react with an overshoot in sensation, resulting in a feeling of pleasure. Alesthesia can only occur under conditions of discomfort and can only be temporary because it would approach neutrality once immediate discomfort is relieved.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So how does one's outdoor environment impact thermal alesthesia?
So outdoor environment can impact our thermal sensations in various ways. For instance, morphological conditions that influence wind and shade patterns would impact microclimate and in their turn our sensations. Materials that are used, depending on how much solar energy they absorb and reflect, could affect thermal sensations as well. From the social side, level of acclimatization, expectations of the weather and environment that people are in would also affect our sensations and level of comfort. Nature and vegetation has been proven to not only provide actual cooling benefits, but also increase our feeling of thermal comfort. But when we talk about alesthesia, since it's a transient condition, it's highly dependent on our previous experience. For instance, if we just walked out from the freezing office, outdoor heat would feel pleasant for some time. So it's important to explore how people traverse through urban spaces to better understand triggers of alesthesia. For instance, in my research, I found that even small changes in microclimate resulted in increased pleasure. And that was mostly due to more shade, trees on the streets, and some breeze.
It's amazing how much relief you can feel here in Phoenix walking under shade rather than in the sun. I know personally, I prioritize the shade over the distance I'm even going to be walking when I'm heading into work in the morning. So relatedly, you mentioned in your article that there is the actual heat risk and the perceived heat risk. How much do these differ?
Yes, in my work, I study both the actual environmental conditions from which I can calculate different heat stress indices, as well as subjective perceptions of people who are actually walking in the city. Understanding the relationship between the two helps us to understand how to design thermally safer and more comfortable cities. Actual environmental conditions do not always match thermal perceptions, though. For example, in my work, I found that even though trees provide smaller improvements of thermal conditions compared to more solid man-made shade, for instance, from buildings, trees are preferred and perceived as having more cooling benefits by people. Other sensory experiences like noise, for instance, or proximity to traffic can affect sensations and willingness to walk. In my study, I found that an arterial road with high traffic load was perceived as hotter than nearby area with vacant land because people perceived it as safer and also breezier.
That's fascinating. Like, I can definitely relate. I made so many of these choices on my own walk this morning. I'm sure our listeners have thought about these things while they're commuting, or at least using active form of transportation, probably not so much if they're driving into work. But when we are thinking of these active modes of transportation, why is it important to understand the actual and perceived risks of heat?
So I think if perceived risk is low, then people can potentially expose themselves to unsafe conditions by spending too much time outside and not taking enough heat precautions. Assessing the risks properly would include understanding the exposure. In case of active transit, it would be the walking and waiting time if they use public transit, or riding time if they are biking. Furthermore, it involves understanding of personal sensitivity to heat, as well as protective measures an individual can take. However, if risk is too high, then it can also have negative effects. For instance, it can limit physical activity or prevent people from using active transportation. So I think it's important that city actively communicates risks and benefits, as well as assists with adaptation measures. One of them can be designing urban spaces with heat in mind.
So on that point, what advice would you give urban planners?
In the conditions of extreme heat like Phoenix, and generally considering that climate is warming, I think we should move away from aiming towards considering neutral as optimal. Instead, urban planners could concentrate on how to create islands of relief or islands of pleasure within the city that would evoke this pleasure sensations. In this case, it's important to understand under what conditions does alesthesia appear and how long does it last in order to design urban streets accordingly.
I love this idea of coming back to we're designing cities for the people who are living in them. So thank you for that, Yulia. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Alicia.
Next, we're going to speak with Adora, who recently published work on heat-ready schools, which again, the link can be found in the description. Adora, could you explain to us what heat-ready schools are?
Yeah, absolutely. So in our work, we have defined heat-ready schools as those that are able to identify, prepare for, mitigate, track, and respond to the negative impacts of school grounds heat.
And how does heat impact children?
So heat negatively impacts children in a variety of ways, including social, psychological, meaning mental, and physiological, meaning physical. And because children's thermoregulatory systems are not fully developed, they're still developing, that means children are more vulnerable to extreme heat than adults are, because they cannot accurately detect when their bodies are overheating, therefore when it's time to take action and cool down, to take a break and cool down. And these impacts can also influence their educational performance in the classroom, in social situations, and in their ability to self-regulate, both physically, emotionally, mentally, and so on.
Right. So it's this pressure on young children that they may not even realize is even there, and it's impacting their ability to kind of go about day-to-day activities. And I think you identified three general themes for heat-ready schools within your publication, and these were awareness, response, and barriers. Could you describe these themes and maybe an example of applicability within a school?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. So the first theme, awareness, and these are not, as a side note, these are not hierarchical. These are like all separate and together. So more like a circle. They're not one is more important than the other. They're all very equally important and work together. So we can't really talk about one without talking about the others. That said, awareness can be described as the level of knowledge that the school, and the school meaning district manager, the principals, the administrators, teachers, students, parents, like anyone who is involved directly and indirectly with the school, the level of knowledge that they have about the issue of extreme heat and what impacts extreme heat has. So for example, are they aware that heat is negatively impacting children? Are they aware that they can do something about it, even if it's very small, minor things? Like for example, sending out an email to parents to encourage and advise them not to send their students or their children to school with sweaters on, or to make sure that they have a water bottle with them for recess. And response can be described as what the school, again, meaning all the staff and the related community, what the school is doing about improving the environment to reduce the extreme heat impacts. For example, are they taking action to educate their school community about extreme heat? Are they planning short and long term for how to improve the extreme heat environment in their school? And are they seeking support for these endeavors? For example, this can be like making sure that if it's over 105 or 100 degrees, depending on where you're at in the valley or in another part of the world, are we canceling recess instead of having the children going outside? That's a really good, easy, not easy in all cases, but a relatively simple response that schools can do to help not have students be impacted as extremely. And barriers, these can be described as what things are preventing or hindering the school from taking action on improvement to reduce the extreme heat impacts. So these can be things such as the lack of education or awareness on the issue, like maybe they don't know about it, or maybe they know about it, but they just don't know the depth or like the breadth of how much it's impacting themselves and students. Also things such as lack of funding availability and understaffing and or overworked staff. These last two things were some of the most profound and common responses that we got from interviews and surveys in the project of creating Heat Ready Schools.
Right. So you've mentioned a lot of different scales of responses towards heat awareness, whether it's an individual realizing just not to send their child into school with a sweater in the summer, or if it's more institutional, setting these rules or norms not to have recess when it's over 105 degrees outside. So I was curious how you have considered these themes more explicitly across different scales.
Yeah, this is a super great question, and one that has been talked about in the beginning, middle, end, and after our research project. In smaller, more rural communities, it's a lot more site-specific because generally there's not as many opportunities for small or even large funding pools for the school to help improve their physical, social, and environment, and like the environment around the school. So a lot of that, those funding opportunities might have to be done themselves. So it really depends on the school, and that can be said for an urban area and a rural community.
So you say bring this out to other communities, bring this out to other schools. Could you tell me a bit more about the actionable 30 recommendations that you created through this research for schools? Could you potentially highlight the top priority ones that schools concerned about heat readiness could implement?
Yes, I'm happy to do this. So in short, there are 5 different action areas that schools can begin to look at for where they're at and what they're doing. The first one being school policy. And if there is not a school policy on extreme heat and what to do when it is extremely hot outside, then the recommendation is to just create an informal policy. For example, even if this means that the principal or the school nurse just checks their phone for the school weather and sees that it's going to be 115 out today, then maybe they say, let's keep the kids inside for recess today instead of having them go out. So even an informal policy is better than no policy. The second action area is environment. So one of the small hanging fruit that we could suggest for schools to begin with is having access to reusable water bottles, allowing all the students to have access to these water bottles, or having a lot of water fountains around the school campus so that students and staff can stay hydrated on really hot days. The next one is training, and there is a free free heat training done by the CDC. You can find this on the Heat Ready Schools website. So we recommend that to help prepare for the heat season, the school requires all the staff, meaning teachers, and students, and hopefully parents, to watch and take this free training. You can find that link on the website as well. The next category for actionable areas is prevention. So one small, easy hanging fruit thing that that parents and teachers can do is to encourage the students to drink water before, during, and after all recess hours and outdoor activities, especially during high heat periods. And the last action area is community. And one of the highest recommendations that we would like to offer for schools is to encourage the parents to give the school nurse their child's heat susceptibility information, meaning what types of things is this student allergic to, or are there any health factors that we need to be extra careful for so that we can keep an eye on the student when it is really hot out. So those are just a handful of examples of things that we have recommended out of all 30 lists of things in our Heat Ready School tool.
You mentioned a couple of times that there's a Heat Ready School's website. Could you elaborate on the resources available on that page?
Yes, I would love to. So on the Heat Ready School's website, there is information about what the project is, what does a Heat Ready School mean, how is it being implemented, all questions that you could have about the project, who, what, when, where, why, how. And most importantly, there's also a hub of resources on this website where you can print out educational posters and flyers to hang in your school or to send out in emails, as well as external links to the training for the CDC, potential funding organizations, and other community groups that are working on increasing shade or reducing the impacts of extreme heat, as well as who you can contact more about information on this project.
Perfect. We'll have the link to that website in our description. And thank you, Adora, for all this information. This is also a great segue into our next speaker, Dave Hondula, who has worked on both of the projects that have been presented by Yulia and Adora, and is now working on a public service lead with the City of Phoenix with the Office of Heat Mitigation and Response, which is another great resource for everyone within the Valley to use during these hot summer days.
So Dave, could you elaborate on why the City of Phoenix decided to create this office?
Yeah, we're really proud at the city to have made this innovative step. Phoenix is just one of a handful of cities around the world that have done something like this. There are a number of cities that have appointed chief heat officers in partnership with some philanthropic organizations. Los Angeles City Council just made a move similar to what Phoenix has done. We have, as part of the public budget in the city management team, an office focused on heat response and mitigation. And we think about what those words mean as both short-term strategies that can help keep people safe in the summer and long-term strategies that can cool the city and make it more comfortable. So why are cities making this move is an interesting question. And here, at least in Arizona, we kept finding ourselves asking the question, who is responsible for coordinating heat-related initiatives? If residents are having a challenge with crime in their city, they know who to call. If their trash isn't getting collected, they know who to call. But if they feel like their neighborhood is too hot, who do they call? Or if they think too many people are getting sick from heat in the community, who do they call? And every time we ask that question at a public meeting, there's a pause as folks think about it and aren't sure. And that ambiguity, we argue, has translated into missed opportunities and underperformance in cities all across the country in tackling what we are now recognizing is a major public health challenge for us. So our goal in creating this new office was to add a little clarity to the structure and function of city government, that there is a point person and a point team for coordination. That certainly doesn't mean we're responsible. We just have a team of four at the city. So we are not responsible for implementing and operating the many, many, many different programs that are heat relevant, but we can act as a coordinator. We can look for synergies, look for redundancies, and be a persuasive voice as well when we're trying to balance the many, many, many trade-offs that cities have to think about.
So I'm curious, I've heard that with 311 numbers within cities that oftentimes you'll find with different socioeconomic demographics, there will be varying degrees of usage of that platform to communicate with the city.
And so is there an effort to help make sure this resource is known everywhere throughout the valley, or how is that being communicated to different communities?
Yeah, that's certainly been one of the lessons learned and experiences that I was fortunate to be able to have in the academic space that I'm trying to bring into work at the city. Had a chance to work with some of our awesome ASU teammates on a neighborhood-based heat action planning process a number of years ago. And one of the clearest memories from that project, we were working in underserved hot neighborhoods where folks might be less likely to do the reporting you're talking about or have been engaged by the city in the past. And we were so fortunate one Saturday morning at elementary school gym, a parks employee came and we were having some conversation about, I think we were citing water fountains in a park or something like that. It's kind of, important, but a small detail in the grand scheme of city operations. And multiple people at that meeting, residents of the neighborhood, said to the parks employee, "Thank you for being here. This is the first time I've ever been able to speak to someone from the city, not just about water fountains, just about heat, but at all." And that experience has really stuck with me. And while there are some usual mechanisms that are typical mechanisms that are important for us to engage at the city, our public advisory boards, village planning committees, we need to be looking far beyond those engagement opportunities. And we're trying to do so, trying to be creative. And even if that's just small conversations with three or four people at a time, we think that can make a really big difference. And I'll also say, in response to your question, in terms of responding to the public health need, we have a great advantage here in Central Arizona that the Maricopa County Department of Public Health has what is arguably the world's best surveillance program for tracking how many people get sick and die from heat in the community. So we don't have to just rely on someone with extra time on their hands raising their hand at a meeting and saying, you know, come help our neighborhood that you've already helped in the past. But we can look at the public health data, and you know that doesn't require folks to opt into participating. We can see where the need is. We can see the need in the underserved communities. We can see the need in communities that are really hard to organize in any means, like our unsheltered community, where the public health impacts of heat are tremendously high. And I think we've done a good job getting started in using those data to try to understand where to be, who to talk to, and what resources to invest.
So along those lines, I was curious if you could tell me a little bit about a few ongoing projects or new initiatives within the office.
Yeah, well, as we're recording, it's the middle of the summer, and responding to summer heat is consuming a lot of our time and energy, as it should. And as we've seen here in Phoenix and many other cities around the country, the number of unsheltered people and people experiencing homelessness is higher now than it has been in recent recorded history. And folks who are living on the streets and without access to regular shelter are absolutely at the highest risk for heat illness and death, not only because of the high exposure folks have and that they are outside in the heat for many, many hours of the day, but we also see chronic health challenges and some other barriers in accessing medical services that are additional amplifiers of risk. So we've been working hard and working with community partners to try to do more outreach to our unsheltered neighbors, and also investing as a city in more shelter options and so on to help as well. Just for a couple of examples, we have a We're Cool outreach program that deploys city staff and volunteers out to parts in the city where there tend to be higher numbers of unsheltered neighbors, to not only get heat relief supplies in folks' hands that can make an immediate improvement, like a hat, a cooling towel, a bottle of cold water, but we share information about community cooling resources like public cooling centers and hydration stations. This year, we have free transportation available thanks to a grant from a utility. By calling 211, anyone in the community can get a free ride to and from a cooling center. We're not finding that there's been very high awareness of that opportunity. Transportation is such a limiting factor for so many folks. And on our We're Cool team, we have professional case managers from the city's human and homeless services teams. So for folks who are interested to have a conversation about shelter, housing, ID, food stamps, social security income. We can have those conversations on the spot. And those are the big wins that we're really after. And visiting a cooling center is great and can be helpful for a short-term strategy, but housing is a really, really important solution. So we're about one out of every 10 folks we see in the community. We're able to have some type of referral through human services, and we need to accumulate a lot more of those and keep building the additional community-wide resources to help. We've encountered about 1,700 folks thus far this year, and you know, we're hopeful to be making a difference there. I'll also note that thanks to one of the city councilors in Phoenix, we've been able to support now close to 50 community organizations with heat relief supplies. We know that community organizations can reach more people than the city can on its own. And of course, there are different relationships that people in the community have with the city. And it might be the case that a community organization can be more effective than we can. So we've been able to support these 50 community organizations with about 35,000 individual heat relief items that they are getting out into the community. And it's been a rewarding partnership to see. And you know, when we show up in a neighborhood where we haven't been before and we see supplies already there, that's encouraging. And we know that those community organizations are also working to help folks move on trajectories that can get them access to healthcare, housing, whatever the big solutions are that might be needed.
I want to circle back. You mentioned the importance of housing, and obviously there's the importance of people feeling empowered to keep the electricity on or the AC on then through the summer. Do you know if there's any financial support or programs to help keep the AC running in more vulnerable households in Phoenix?
Yeah, there are a couple of different ways that different agencies are working to try to keep the power on. Speaking about keeping the power on quite literally, the Corporation Commission had a change in policy recently, the State Corporation Commission, that prohibits utilities from disconnecting power on more days of the summer. And the specific implementation varies from utility to utility. And SRP, which is not regulated by the Corporation Commission, has a different set of rules as well. But in terms of keeping the power on for more days, I think that was an important policy change. And you know, we will still be learning the consequences of it in terms of how folks are repaying bills and so on. But that's one way that the power is being kept on. And cities in the state still have a fair amount of resources related to the various COVID packages that are helping pay rent, helping pay utilities. My sense is that some agencies, including the city, have a bottleneck in filtering folks into that program, going through an application process, interview process. So the money is there, and our challenge is getting appointments scheduled to ensure that we are meeting need and qualifying applicants into the program. So many organizations are short-staffed right now, and this is not just a municipal government problem. As we look all across the board, across sectors, we're understaffed. So I'm hopeful that we can open up that bottleneck a little bit. The state has a program as well that I understand can operate a little faster than the cities can. But there is money there. The challenge is getting it out as quickly as we can.
Mm-hmm. And so all these efforts by the office are to prepare Phoenix for more extreme heat and more extreme temperatures in the future as we're adapting for climate change. I read there's an initiative called Heat Ready Phoenix. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, this was an initiative that we had a chance to get started with some Bloomberg funding a couple of years ago, a partnership between ASU and the city and a number of partners. And a question we even still get, I mean, the phone will ring at our office from another city that says, what's the playbook for taking on this heat hazard? How do we do it? And until very recently, there hasn't been a playbook of any kind. Our colleagues, Sarah Miro and Ladd Keith, wrote with the American Planning Association a book on heat management for cities, which I think is a wonderful resource. And what Heat Ready was meant to be was a certification rubric scorecard style program where cities could look at a checklist of sorts and assess if they had some of the pieces in place that could help ensure that they were preparing communities for current and future heat, similar to the Storm Ready program that the National Weather Service runs right now, which has certified more than 3,000 communities across the United States. Storm Ready really ensures that there's a line of communication between local government and the National Weather Service office so that when a tornado, a severe thunderstorm, or hurricane comes through, that dialogue is happening, that shelter plans are already in place, that folks have their weather radios up and running. And we're big champions of the Storm Ready program, but we also know that there might be some different tactics for preparing for heat than we would use to prepare for severe storms. So we've been trying to prepare a parallel program of sorts that we've had the chance to pilot test with a couple other cities here. We've encountered maybe what should have been obvious in the past, because aren't many people in city government who interpreted their job to be working on extreme heat. Whose job is it to fill out the application form to participate in the Heat Ready program has also been an interesting challenge to learn as well. But we're making progress there. And I think what's most important is that the Heat Ready effort and other efforts all across the country are accelerating the dialogue about what cities can do. I feel very confident that cities have their hands on some really important levers for helping cool communities and help keep people safe when it is hot. And now I think we're seeing cities really come pull their chair more closer to the table for the heat dialogue than they have in the past.
So for cities that may still be lingering against the walls being wallflowers, would you have any advice or any pieces of low hanging fruit that could help them get more involved in being heat ready?
Yeah. So it seems to be in vogue at the moment to appoint a chief heat officer or something like the Phoenix model or Los Angeles model. But I think when we think practically, especially about the experience of small and medium-sized cities across the United States, I mean, in some cases, they may not have an emergency manager. They may have never had a sustainability manager. I mean, they might be happy just to have a city manager in the first place. So is it a practical future where every city is going to have an office or a singular person focused on heat? I don't know. And time will tell if this has been the right model for Los Angeles, Phoenix, Miami, and other cities as well. But I do think 9 months into the job, a lesson that all cities could take is that clarifying where leadership for heat falls in the organization can be important. And what gives me confidence in saying that is about every week, a fellow city employee will come to me and say, David, I've kind of been kicking around this idea. I've had this little pet project related to heat in the past, but I wasn't sure if I should spend a lot of time on it. Like, it's not really my job. We've got our other things to do in the XYZ department, but now you're here and you're positioned in the city manager's office and you got this title that suggests that you should be working on heat. So here's this start of a good idea. Can you take it and run with it? And it's like the organization has all this potential energy that now that we have some dedicated staff to think about it, we can convert into kinetic energy that will help improve how our city is responding to extreme heat. And it's just been that clarification that there is a person who should bring your heat ideas to that I think has been helpful.
Yeah, really creating that space and recognition of sustainability efforts, I think, at large.
To that point, I wonder if where the heat conversation is now is where the sustainability conversation was 15, 20, 25 years ago.
So you have gone from your role in academia and taken the service leave to fill in as the lead for the Office of Heat Response and Mitigation. How did your background in academia prepare you or not for this role?
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's something I do think about any chance we have to reflect. And I certainly want to attest that I was not perfectly prepared for this job, not 9 months in. I'm not sure anybody would have been perfectly prepared for it, in part because it is a new job. It's never been tried before anywhere in the world. But as I think about what in my background might have been helpful, and I'm very cautious in talking about what might have been helpful because we don't know if our office has succeeded yet. So I'm just speculating here. I did have a chance to come from an interdisciplinary program in undergrad and grad school. And I think being comfortable having different conversations and switching between vocabularies has been really important. Because we work with so many different departments, streets, human services, parks, we need to be comfortable engaging in different conversations and switching between them very, very quickly. Having competency, having basic fluency or basic language skills with so many different partners has been really important. And I think any type of multidisciplinary training can be helpful in that regard. Being willing to attend meetings with partners across sectors was really important. As I look back on the past 5, 6, 7 years, I mean, it was serendipity that somebody from the public health department happened to come to a seminar I was giving and invite me to participate in work group with them, and saying yes to go back to those meetings and learn how different organizations that do their work and how the city might fit in. It's been helpful. I listened to a lot of sports press conferences and watched some stand-up comedy from time to time. And those are both really interesting public speaking settings where in the sports world, you know, the sort of coaches are trying to put their spin on what they're doing and tell a coherent story. And I don't know of any more challenging public speaking role than stand-up comedy. I'm not formally trained in public speaking, but public speaking is a really important part of the work of the HEAT office at the city, engaging community meetings, talking to the media, talking to city council, and being somewhat comfortable in that space, maybe with some lessons that I've accidentally learned from watching press conferences and some stand-up comedy from time to time, it has been really helpful on a day-to-day basis.
So maybe I'll squeeze in one more question in reverse, which is, now that you've had this role in the city of Phoenix, what are some takeaways you have when you transition back to full-time academia?
Yeah, I think we can work even closer with cities than we have been. I mean, we're really proud at ASU for our many relationships with cities, and I think we do a great job of it. But we've probably left some opportunities on the table, at least in the HEAT space. I mean, I don't know if it's every day, but there are a lot of times each week and each month I look for data sets that feel like, you know, they're sort of the basics that I would need to do this job. And we've had we've had great research projects at ASU in the HEAT space and working with the city, but some of the basics haven't been there. And I don't know if it's exactly the university's job, you know, to do that work. I'm still trying to learn, you know, how the university, you know, sort of works and how its mission aligns with the city mission. And at ASU, we try to interweave them together. I wish I had attended more day-to-day routine meetings and workshops and listened to more city council meetings, just to kind of get the sense for the day-to-day. I certainly wouldn't say that I've been like blindsided making the switch, because I engage in some of that, but I think I could have done more of that. And I think as we think about training future students, how do we integrate that into our curriculum as we think about recognizing the efforts of junior faculty? How do we integrate that in? That's a conversation we have a lot at ASU, is how are we recognizing this work that doesn't always translate into publications and presentations, but is really important toward community service goals. That'll be something I think a lot about in continuing dialogue with academic partners.
A big thank you to each of our guests today, Yulia Dzubin, Adora Shortridge, and David Hondula. And thank you to everyone who listened to this month's episode of Future Cities. As we part ways, we will leave you with a couple of haikus. Yulia?
I walk on a stove. There's a tree at this bus stop. Island of relief.
And Adora?
It's really hot out. Let's connect to help all out. Cool down, in and out.
The Future Cities podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by Natura-based solutions for urban resilience in the Anthropocene, or Natura. To learn more, please visit www.natura-net.org. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at futurecitiespodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at futurecitiespod. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.